it was also this moment where I told myself, you don't have anything else. You can't go to these places to heal. You do have a printmaking studio, though.
Hello, print friends, and welcome. This is a bilingual podcast, so if you subscribe to us, you'll be getting episodes in English with me, as well as in Spanish with Reynaldo Gil Zambrano. Together, we speak to people around the globe about their practice and passions in the world of print media and multiples. Hello, Print Friend is brought to you by Speedball Art Products. And in 1915, Ross F. George published the first edition of the Speedball textbook, which quickly became a superlative resource for artists and letterers of all skill levels. This is a great inspiration for the gig poster gang or for people who want to develop their own letter forms for screen and relief printed work. In celebration of the 105th anniversary of this book's debut, the 25th edition of the Speedball textbook has a convenient lay-flat construction and 120 pages of examples, contributors' works, and innovative technical insight that is sure to inspire and appeal to scribes and enthusiasts across the spectrum of skill and experience. There's a link in the show notes. This episode is also brought to you by Legion Paper. Legion is a fine art paper company that represents the best papers in the world. They either stock it, source it, or make it. With brands like Stonehenge, Somerset, Coventry, Reeves, Arches, and more, Legion is the best paper resource for every artist and printmaker's needs. Learn more about the variety of papers Legion stocks at www.legionpaper.com. One more quick note before we get into this week's episode. I want to give a shout out to the SGCI conference happening next month in Providence, Rhode Island. If you haven't been to one of these conferences before, they are a blast. It is days and days of printmaking content to make your heart sing. Exhibitions, talks, demos, open portfolios, a vendor fair, and much, much more. Registration closes on March 27th, so don't delay. My guest this week is Courtney Tralia. We talk about her experience working in the print studio at Columbia Teachers College in New York City throughout the height of the COVID-19 pandemic. We also talk about trauma, grief, and how print and poetry can guide us through this. So in case you haven't guessed, we talk about death, PTSD, and those scary early days of the pandemic, as well as lots of hope and healing. But all the same, take care when listening. Hi, Courtney. How's it going?
Hi, Miranda. It's nice to meet you.
Yeah, it's very nice to meet you, too. Thank you for reaching out and suggesting we have this chat. You sent me a really nice email, and it had a lot of things that have been on my mind lately, and I think a lot of things that were kind of getting to the point of being able to process and think about and talk about. Mm-hmm. And I include myself in that personally. And so I thought this would be a really nice opportunity to create a space for those conversations and to hear your story. So I'm excited to do that. Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you so much. I actually first found out about your podcast when it was during the pandemic. And at the time, nobody could be anywhere. Everyone had to quarantine for a few months. And I just needed printmaking in any sort of way. Like if you could grind it up into a smoothie, I would have drank it, you know? So that's how I found this podcast. And I was just so relieved that there were other people out there who wanted to talk about printmaking as much as I did. And then after getting into your podcast, I started finding the artist that you interviewed, I started meeting people on Instagram who I still message to this day, and realized that it was so fun to find a printmaking community outside of being in a printmaking space during that time.
Oh, I'm so happy to hear that. Thank you for saying that. And of course, just a huge shout out, a huge love for all of my guests during the pandemic who really showed up to have those conversations during a really vulnerable, unsure time for everyone. So Yeah, that was, it helped me immensely as well, just to, as you say, feel less alone and to get that little window of normalcy of these people are still here.
Right.
We're still interested in this and no one is forgetting about each other. No one is forgetting about this community during right. this time. So, yeah. So thank you to all of those guests. And yeah, thank you for the kind words. So before we get into the pandemic printmaking intersection chat, I'd love to just hear a bit of background about you, kind of in the, my husband and I call it the before four time. We want to talk about things that happened before 2020. So why don't we just start with the classic questions of who you are, where you are, what you do?
So I am from New York. I still live in New York. I've sort of straddled between living in Long Island in New York City and also at the complete opposite end of the state in Rochester, New York. I had a lot of extended family that lived in Rochester. And growing up, my parents thought it was really important for me to spend time with them and bless them for taking those trips every single season break that we could because it was always like the 8-hour trek upstate. Yeah.
Yeah. As someone who is in Western New York and who has many reasons to go to quote unquote the city.
Yeah.
I know that drive. Yeah.
Yep. And I love that Wegmans has sort of infiltrated New York City. But for so long, it was just such a gift to go up to Rochester and for like 3 hours at a time. But so it was nice to have this sort of balance of being near the city and having all these fun experiences. But also at the same time, Long Island is very class-based. So, you know, I always thought that we grew up with like a really, really great family and we had food on the table, we had a home. Like, I feel like even as I explained sort of like what was seen as stigma back then, it's like we didn't own a home. Mm-hmm. We went out to go do our laundry. And it's so wild to me to even say that that was like a stigma then, because to me, that's just life. It's not even anything to judge about, but at the time it was.
Mm.
So sort of having that separation and going to Rochester and going to family and a town where like forest and nature is so much a part of it, I feel like really helped my values and helped shape what I love about nature. So a lot of my artwork contains elements of like nature and the earth, but also kind of mixes it with these surreal fairy tale, like kind of sci-fi creatures. Mm. And I sort of use those to manifest how I'm feeling or what I'm experiencing.
Yeah. And so in this life where you had this balance of Long Island and then really, really beautiful nature of Western New York. It is truly stunning here. So in this childhood that you had where you're going between that really urban existence to the more rural existence and the real beauty of Western New York, where was art in all of that? Were you immediately identified by teachers and peers as an artsy kid? Did you have art influences in the family or crafting? What was that time like?
It was just as inherent as breathing for me. Mm. It started very early. I have a picture of my parents took us on vacation to the Bahamas. I had to be like 2 years old.
Mm.
And they drop us off to like the childcare there, which is so great for parents, but devastating for me at the time. I was horrified that my mom was leaving me. And when they came to pick us up, they were like, okay, you can paint your parents' faces. And I just very vengefully put a mustache on my mom's face. And we see that as like the pinnacle moment of like Courtney uses art to express how she's feeling. And I do have I have a very creative family where it was very fostered, but it was very different. So my mom liked to draw a little bit. My dad was a musical theater person.
Mm.
And then my sister is also like a crazy, insane and talented musician. She has shifted her career into pastry, but I still see that as such an artistry because she will spend 6 hours making a homemade palm tart. And I can't imagine if you asked me to spend 6 hours printmaking, totally fine. If you ask me to spend 6 hours making a homemade crust, I'd hate it.
Yeah.
So I think that there's still so much value in that. But so my dad was a musical theater person and he loved singing and acting, but he went into law to provide himself with a career that he felt like was sustainable. And even then, he didn't really want to go into law to be a private lawyer. He did it to serve the community, and he became an assistant district attorney. So he was always very supportive of us following our dreams. So it was really much like, okay, like if you're going to do this, then you got to really want it and we'll help you get there. But then you've got to find out like what you need, what you got to do. And, you know, it was also like, you got to make sure it's clean when you are doing stuff around the house. So it was very much like, we will support this, but here are some expectations for it.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was just always something I was doing. It was just always my way of expressing.
And so what about printmaking? When does that come into your story?
Yeah. So the first time I did printmaking, and now I feel like it's much more common now that I work in art education. But when I was in elementary school, we had one project where it was drawing on the little styrofoam plates. And I never got to do that again in my entire K through 12 education. Mm-hmm. I never got to do printmaking again. And I just remember that being like such a special thing, but it never came up again, you know? And then it wasn't until college that I took printmaking and I hated it.
No.
It was not a good studio space. Mm. And also like when you're 18 and 19 and there's still like this like friend drama or boyfriend drama or relationship stuff, I still was kind of more fixated on that than whatever was happening in the classroom. And then you get away with it. And then you kind of feel like, well, then I have no attachment to this. So I really couldn't get into it. It wasn't until I started working in education. I worked as an early childhood educator and they offered credit with a university. And I was like, I just want to go back for my master's. I'll go to whatever school they offer. That's totally fine. And it ended up being Columbia University.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. So I was like, well, now I have to get into it. So that scared me. that was terrifying. And I got accepted. And so I started my master's in art and art education at Teachers College. And my advisor at the time suggested take courses in things you don't know.
Mm.
And I was like, okay, well, I know painting and I know drawing, but nothing ever felt quite like my form of making. I just felt like I didn't have it yet. I loved animation in my undergrad, but it is exhausting and it's very hard, very time consuming. And then I decided to sign up for two classes, one in silkscreen and one in etching. And it just immediately consumed my entire being. And also I felt welcomed by the people who had already been a part of that space for so long. And it felt like I found myself and I found myself as a person within this space. And then just after that, I just absorbed every part of printmaking I could take in and just quickly took off with it.
And so you graduated and started working, and then 2020 comes along. And when you reached out, you were particularly interested in talking about the experiences of the pandemic. And as I mentioned a little bit earlier in the podcast, I almost feel like I'm just ready to start reflecting now.
Sure.
I definitely went through a time where I didn't want to talk about it. I wanted to just not think about it and wanted to almost a sort of suspicious or superstitious, if I talk about it, is it going to come back? Ooh. Are we going to get another wave? You know, that kind of feeling of just wanting space. So it's really nice timing that you're willing and open to have that conversation now, because I feel like I am finally too.
Yeah.
So I'd love to know, where were you in life when you first realized that this novel virus was going to be a thing?
Novel.
You know, because I
I've had COVID a couple times, and it's for me, the first time was quite rough, and I even ended up like going to the emergency room once, and I was okay. But I would lie on the sofa and I would look at my husband, Tim, and I'd be like, this is a novel virus. Like, yeah. I just felt so different. Like, I'd never felt sick in that way before.
Yeah.
So, yeah, but like just kind of to sort of set the scene of what was your life like? And do you remember when you realized, oh, this is going to be a thing? Because it had kind of been in the news a little bit, but we had had other stories of viruses like SARS or swine flu,
bird flu too. Okay.
Yeah. That kind of were like, okay, this could be a problem, but it never reached the global scale that this one did. So yeah, just, I think you understand what I'm trying to get at, but just like that moment of like when you were like, oh, this is going to be a life-changing event.
It's really interesting because I feel like printmaking and who I became through printmaking is such an important part of my experience during the pandemic, because as I had spent time in the printmaking studio at Teachers College, I had to like stop for a little while because I just didn't have the class for it. There was no reason to with my master's. That was like, I had to move on to other classes, and I felt physically ill leaving the studio and cleaning up my locker, and it felt wrong. And I remember texting my now husband. I was like, I don't feel good. I don't feel good. And then I also kind of realized at that time that I was ready to leave early childhood because it's a very exhausting job.
Yeah.
In general, we need more childcare in our country, but it just sort of felt like the more I was doing printmaking, the more I wanted to be a part of it. And then the position opened for the printmaking studio fellow. And I had to like inhale it. Like, I needed it so badly. And I was so excited when I got it. This is all leading up to the pandemic, because this is summer of 2019, and you don't realize when you're going through summer of 2019 that like everything leading up to it is not going to be what it was. So leading up to me getting to leave my job and work more as an artist, which also felt like a really, really daunting task to like leave a full-time job, pay out of pocket for whatever classes I had left and work as an artist. My dad passed away when I was celebrating my 28th birthday. I was turning 28, and we were in the hospital saying goodbye to him. Mm. So this big life-changing thing happened on my birthday. Yeah. And at the same time, he was going to see me graduate. So that was really tough. And I thought that just that alone was the thing that I was going to have to overcome.
Yeah.
Not knowing that this other thing was going to happen, right? So I feel like the way that I felt at that time is very much what you're describing about the pandemic and about COVID, is that I just sort of closed that door. Like, my dad had passed. I was taking care of my mom. My sister lives in Boston, but it felt like I was sort of supporting them while they grieved. And I closed that door. I was like, I got to do what I have to do to protect my family and work as an artist. And then I think in like November or December, you start hearing people are getting sick in China. And I started to witness at TC, which is a very, it has a big Chinese community. I started to see them getting treated differently. And I could see it from like in a distance, you know, it was happening around me. And then as we got closer in January, my classmates weren't allowed to return to the classroom. And then that became very jarring to me. And then I think in February, I was able to finish my research thesis. I got a grant for my thesis, which was around art making and losing a parent at a young age. And then I was going to go to Austin to see my best friend who lives on the other side of the country. She was my college roommate in undergrad. My dad loved her because she could be very snarky around me. And we were texting each other and we're like, hey, what do you think is going on? Should we still go meet each other? We were going to Austin to meet each other in the middle. And we were like, well, we don't get to see each other. We only get to see each other every 3 years. So I don't want to miss this. Do you want to miss this? And we're like, no, let's still go. And then every day that we were in Austin, it just kept getting worse and worse and worse. So being in New York City while the COVID pandemic is erupting exponentially, I wasn't in New York. I was visiting a friend. We were going to Austin. And every day I woke up and I'm getting texts from my family and friends saying, are you going to be able to come back here? You know? And even then, my friend and I had the conversation again. We're like, are we okay to be here? Do you want to go home early? And I was like, I just want to spend time with you. Even if we were just like in the hotel lobby eating some burgers, and then the next day we take our flight home. Mm-hmm. So then when I came home, it felt like I was like sort of immediately like not, I was immediately ambushed by just the level of what was happening around New York City. And it very quickly changed. So that was really terrifying to me. Mm-hmm. And also my mom and my roommates at the time all lived really close to each other, but they all work in fields where they needed to be out there still. So my mom had to work at a doctor's office. My husband is a mechanic for disabled drivers. So he makes cars more accessible. He has to be in a space where he's helping people. And also my roommates at the time worked at care facilities for older individuals. So we sort of created this little, what I call my little village of people where we could help each other. Like one worked at Harmon's, rest in peace. But he was like, I got us toilet paper. I got your mom toilet paper. So we're okay. You know? So it was like, okay, does anybody need tests? I got a couple of tests. I got hazmat face covers. I got masks. Like, we really worked together to keep each other okay. But also at the same time, my grieving was starting to appear. And suddenly these things that kind of help you grieve, I didn't have access to anymore. Mm-hmm. You know, going to the places that you love with someone, spending time with friends, you can't do that when you have to stay away from each other. So that was my introduction.
Yeah. I was going to ask, can I ask when you say your grieving was starting to appear, how did that manifest for you? Like, what did you notice that you were like, oh, this is some delayed grief over the loss of my father? How did you know that that's what that was? And maybe not just like anxiety around the pandemic and all that kind of thing. And I asked this as someone who's recently lost their father and gone through a lot of life changes. Thank you. Yeah. And sometimes for myself, it's kind of difficult to parse. Is this because I've moved across the country? Is this like, what am I feeling? Yeah. So I'm just sort of curious.
I think it's a little bit of both. I think you have to allow yourself to know that it's both, because you're grieving and also there are these things happening at the same time. So the grief is giving you a little, the anxiety is giving you a little. I did notice that I didn't feel like I could ignore it anymore.
Right. Okay. Yeah. That makes sense.
So I'm not sure if it was necessarily that, maybe, and I'm negating myself in that way, but I think that whatever bars I had held up by being really busy and feeling like a quote unquote successful artist, that was around me anymore to keep me busy.
Oh,
You know?
That makes a lot of sense.
So that's when I started to feel not great. And also, like I said, we were in these areas, my areas of professions where my husband or my mom couldn't leave the state. I think that's something we forget about, is that for a while, people couldn't really leave New York State if they worked in a first responder field. So things that we wanted to do, like go to Cape Cod to visit where we spread my father's ashes, wasn't really an option.
Mm.
So moments like that, moments I was looking for in closure, weren't available to me. And then also now I had no access to a printmaking studio.
Yeah.
So I tried very hard to start printmaking at home. And then very quickly, we became one of the first and only studios to open back up in New York City.
Yeah. We being Teachers College, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Specifically the printmaking studio.
Uh-huh.
It was just us, I think, in July of 2020.
Mm-hmm.
And that's still so early that we had to get special permission just to enter. And I took Polaroids of New York City on that day because it wasn't anything that looked familiar to me. It was just a ghost town. So we started planning, how do we have just one class that's open? How do we give people access to this space in a space that is all about community and sharing tools? So it was a really daunting task. It was just the printmaking studio and the ceramic studio across the hall. So we leaned on each other a lot. And the school itself was completely empty. Columbia was empty. Going on the Long Island Railroad was so quiet in a way that I've never seen. And now I miss a little bit, now that it's sort of back to what it was. It was also this moment where I told myself, you don't have anything else. You can't go to these places to heal. You do have a printmaking studio, though, and you're the one in charge of it. So, like, we're going to be experiencing all these anxieties, and clearly I'm starting to grieve. Let's just make a bunch of art and know that, like, the grieving and the fear and the anxiety, that's inevitable if we're home or we're not home. But at least we have a printmaking studio. So we only had about 8 students at the time, but it just felt like I just needed to get everything out in art form. Everything that I was feeling, I was just constantly making all the time.
Yeah. And so what was behind the decision to open up so early on? I mean, and I think some of that answer is in what you just said about just the isolation and people needing space to make work, to try and process what was happening. But from your point of view, was it just that, or were there other elements to consider as well? Because as you said, July 2020 that's not even the middle.
No. I, to this day, am still not sure what made the higher ups, whoever it may be in this university, made them decide, like, okay, like they made it very clear that some other labs at Columbia University had to open their labs because specimens and data were like dying in the petri dish.
Yeah.
So money was just, and time was being wasted the more that those samples just sort of stayed in the lab. That makes sense to me. I'm still not sure why they let us open up again. It was a crazy decision. Like, even looking back at it now, I still think it's a crazy thing that we went back in so early. But we made it work, and I'm actually so incredibly grateful that they did let us do it, because I don't know what I would have done without it.
Mm-hmm. What was the work like that you were making during that time?
It was really just experiencing whatever I was feeling and manifesting it into something. But I also wanted anybody who doesn't look like me to connect to it. So I started making a lot of these creatures as sort of anti-portraits so that people can sort of insert themselves into the creatures I was making.
Mm.
So, for example, I started doing these aliens with houses for hats, because I've been thinking about, and the book that I made after all of this kind of answers these questions too, or at least experiments with answering these questions of where do we belong? Mm. What are we leaving behind? And I was thinking about how, as we uncover artifacts and things from the past, we're probably getting it about like 80% wrong.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I thought about, like, if we are leaving something behind. The things that find it, are they going to get it right? Probably not. So I sort of picture these like aliens with houses for hats. It's like that. That's their idea of like what a house is supposed to be.
Oh, I see.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I also was terrified at the time that the people who owned my mom's apartment were getting ready to sell the house during the pandemic. So for me, it was also trying to translate this fear of like, where is my mom going to live? Where are we going to live? Because at the time we really wanted to live with her. My husband and I wanted to get a place with her, but Long Island is very expensive and it's very difficult to find a reasonable 2-bedroom apartment in Long Island. So that was one creature I was making a lot of work around, and also sort of like a version of me with big deer antlers, because I felt like antlers on a deer are such an example of like male dominance in nature. It is very strong and actually very terrifying thing if you see it in person. But I put it on myself because it was like, suddenly once my dad was gone, it felt like I became the new head of the household.
Are you the oldest?
I'm the youngest. So having that sort of responsibility placed on me, not by anyone individually, but even my dad kind of knew that I was the more like responsible one. I was kind of like a caretaker at a very young age. Some of that's probably from like growing up a little too fast, but that's the like one version of a character that I made. So, and then sometimes I would just sort of create the shape of a portrait and fill it with something. Like I would make monoprints around Aurora Borealis, but it would be the silhouette of a face, or it would be waves coming and going. So that was a lot of the stuff I was making.
Yeah. So you mentioned the book that you wrote.
Yeah.
And it's a book of poetry, correct?
Yes.
And so that's also another part of your practice is not just the visual side, but the poetry. And so how did that project sort of come about? Were you writing throughout the pandemic and then you realized, oh, I have a book of poetry here? Or was this something that was part of a processing after we started to regain a sense of safety?
I would say I had been writing poetry well into my early 20s. When I was still in my undergraduate, I actually have a couple of poems in there that I wrote when I was like 21. I grew up with a huge fear of death and loss. And normally when I don't have art as an access, like, so the phase where I didn't have the printmaking studio, I started writing more.
Yeah.
And I took my grandfather's typewriter, I cleaned it, and I added some ribbon. And I originally started writing poetry on there. So then during the pandemic, although I had the studio space and people knew that I was grieving this loss, it is a very lonely experience, you know? Even if you have a community, you're still, it's internal. And then I'm literally just on the bus alone, and no one's there to get me from Harlem to Penn Station. So I started writing again. And so it was sort of during all of the uncertainty of what was going to happen that I started writing again. And then now we get to the point where like it really becomes clear that I'm grieving and I'm struggling. The people I was living with at the time got COVID. I'm immunocompromised, so our fear at the time was if Courtney catches it, she's going to the hospital.
Yeah.
So my boyfriend at the time, I should also preface that like the person that I'm speaking about, my husband, Joe, we are high school sweethearts.
Oh.
So we've known each other since we were 13. We were best friends. And then one day we finally just were single at the same time. And I was like, oh my God, this is finally happening. He feels the same way I feel. So then to have that loss during such an uncertain time and then to find out that your person is sick and you have to leave them, mm-hmm. like it's better for yourself to go somewhere else. Was, can I curse? Am I allowed to curse?
Yeah. If not now, when? Yeah.
Yeah. It was the shittiest feeling I've ever felt in my life. And I still feel that. Like when I think about how I felt when I was writing the poem about him, which was called November in the Flames, I felt like I was leaving him in a burning house.
Mm.
And suddenly this like paralyzing level of anxiety took in again that I have not felt since like my undergraduate, since high school. I spent all of this time trying to ward that off, ignoring my grief so I would keep going. And suddenly I just couldn't avoid it anymore. And you had mentioned that you've had COVID a couple of times and one time where it was really bad. Mm-hmm. I never know if I got it or not, but I did test positive. And I was living with my mom. So now my fear was, I left my person to be safe. And now I'm going to get sick and endanger my mother, the only living parent that I have.
Yeah. Was this in pre-vaccine time?
Yeah.
Or, okay. Wow. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think that's the thing that we forget because we know so much now. And it's so different that fear seems like such a distant concept, but it was really prevalent.
Well, that's the thing is even now, I think that we forget almost consciously how much we still don't know and how we're still seeing consequences of people having this manifesting in new and really scary ways. But definitely in those first months, that first year, we didn't have any idea.
Mm-hmm.
What this was or what it was going to, how it was going to affect people. And it just, I mean, even just the other day, I work at a university and I was giving a visiting artist a tour and I went to go up a flight of stairs with them and I turn around and they are, I get to the top and they're only halfway there and they're taking the stairs very slowly. And I said, oh my gosh, I'm so sorry. I should have asked if you were okay with stairs. And she said that she has a heart condition from COVID.
Yeah.
So she has this invisible illness that's that changed her life forever. And so it's those moments like that, I think, that really bring home how much we still don't know. Like why did some people have their internal organs compromised? Right. Why did some people test positive and remain asymptomatic? Like we have no answers to these questions and we still don't know what truly long-term effects are. There's a Radiolab podcast that they talk about how sleeping sickness is likely, historically, when they look back at it, likely the result of the Spanish flu, but it came back 20 years later. And I think about that kind of thing in terms of what we don't know. And I've had COVID 3 times and I'm like, okay.
Oh my gosh. Yeah.
Like it feels a little bit, not, I think a ticking time bomb is a little bit too dramatic of a phrase, but it's something that was in the back of my mind of like, what did this do something to me that I don't know? Is this something that I'm going to discover in 30 years had a consequence for myself? Mm-hmm. So yeah, it's still present, but as you say, that first year, it was that magnified to just an absolute extreme. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think also you had said how, you know, it's been kind of hard for you to, or you're starting to open up to how that was a time that we've lived through. And I think part of it too is how has this altered our physical selves in a country that is already very ableist? You know, we already had lived in a country that doesn't realize accessibility. What is considered accessible really isn't accessible. And now you have more people living with these conditions, and we just don't have, we haven't given the attention that it needs to really understand it and how it's still affecting people.
Yeah. And I wonder how much of that is that desire that I spoke to of just wanting to be like, Don't want to look back. Don't want to think about that. Everyone, back to work. Keep making money. We need to get this economy churning again. And to stop and talk about people who are living with effects of long COVID and truly say, okay, as a society, how do we take care of these people? Or really anyone with a long-term disability, which we're terrible at doing anyway. You know, that's it's like not wanting to turn and face this.
How do we care for each other and for other people? And I think also there are sociological effects too that we're not quite addressing. People are so quick to react to things these days because we've been hunkered down and we just have our phones and our internet to voice our opinions. That does something to you. A lot of people were angry. A lot of people were angry for different reasons. And I'm not saying that all of it was entirely justified, but some of it definitely was, you know. And then also there's just sort of an excitement to do so much. I think it was last year, my friend and I, we just started going to concerts all the time. And then I realized like, oh, I'm older now and I'm exhausted and I have a migraine after going to a concert. But we were just like, we were just dying to be a part of those things again. So I think that's part of it too. It's like there's all these different factors in it.
But yeah, so your book, so you were writing, I mean, that's just, it's such a, that's such a picture that you've painted of just being alone on these buses. And these city that I'm sure is strangely empty and writing, you know? And so, when did the idea of making a book of the poetry and the lino cuts and, and all of that kind of thing start to form for you?
So once I realized that I was like being like controlled by this paralyzing fear again, and I started processing my father's loss, I really needed a project. And also at that time, through finally going to therapy and like addressing these feelings, I was like, I'm going to throw myself into therapy. I'm going to take it so seriously and just be honest about how I'm feeling. And then I was diagnosed with PTSD. And I feel like something that people misinterpret about diagnoses is that it's not that it just appeared. It is not pneumonia, which I've had multiple times, hence the immunocompromised.
But
it's that it's kind of like I was already living with PTSD and I didn't know that I was doing that. This was actually like the turning point for me to start feeling better. We have a name for it. We know different things that can work. Let's try this. So while I was going through the process of getting diagnosed and like learning how to control that, and not necessarily control it because I can't control my brain.
Manage is a,
Becoming friends with it, I guess. Becoming friends with PTSD, becoming friends with my diagnosis.
What are you here to teach me, unwelcome stranger?
It's like, hey, we've been here for a while. We've had some bagels and some coffee. Glad you could join us. Now we can have a conversation about it. I decided I have so many poems, and probably a lot of that was me channeling these things I couldn't quite figure out or quite put a label to. And I realized over time they all told this like larger story about life and death and wanting to be places you couldn't be during a pandemic. And it's like, how do you feel like yourself when you can't go to the places that are so a part of who you are as a person and your memories with people that you loved? So then I started teaching some of the printmaking courses, which was really fun. And being like the assistant was really great because I was always there and I could help people. But to actually teach the courses, they also gave me a grant to make projects that I wanted. So I had heard my mentoring professor say to some other student, like, oh, you're an English student? You can make a book of poetry. And that was like a couple of years ago at this time. And I thought of when she said that and I was like, this is crazy, but I'm going to do it. I'm going to put the poems together. I'm going to line them up. And I really thought about how do I make this as easy for myself as possible? So I started printing them out on paper, putting them in an order to try to tell a story. And then I was like, well, I can find books on my own. But if I'm going to make this possible, I should probably find the best way to bind these books. So I learned how to do 4-stitch. And I just started printing out the poems on silkscreen and exposing them on a silkscreen. And then when we finally were able to go to Cape Cod again, where we scattered my dad's ashes, I brought all of the pages and all the covers with me. I have a video of me with a tote bag in the back of the car, just like bending them with a bone folder. And I made these lino cut prints to kind of create these images around some of the poems. And I started binding them when we were on vacation. And it was a task. It was a project that at the time, every time I said, I'm going to do this, I thought, why am I doing this? This isn't going to go well. But then every time I completed a step, it felt like it was telling me to keep going. And it felt so
great. Like, not going to go well because you were worried about the finished product artistically, or worried about the emotional impact, or what? What was that voice trying to warn you about?
I think I was afraid that however I pictured binding a book, that it wasn't going to come together. Like physically, like I was afraid, like I have an idea of how this will work, but I'm not sure if the execution will meet my expectations. Mm-hmm. And then, so I'm in Cape Cod with my family on vacation, and I'm sitting there like pressing the needle into the pages, and my husband sits down and he like finally like pulls out a copy and he gets the poem about him. And he just like holds out his hand to me, and he just knew. I didn't tell him about it, but he just knew. Mm-hmm. And then I looked over him again, and he's like in tears. And then I thought to myself, like, I don't share my poetry with people. This wasn't something that people knew that I wrote mostly. Uh-huh. So I thought, if I can make him cry and he's an Aries, then I think I might actually be pretty good at this.
Like, yeah.
That was my reaction to every step that I took that I completed. Not necessarily like, did I make my husband cry today? But every step was like, am I completing something that feels good? Should I keep going? And it was a great feeling. And then finished these books, and suddenly they were going places. People were buying them. I went to this like really wonderful progressive vegan bakery cafe in Hyannis that I just went up to the book owner and I said, hey, I see you have some work by local artists. I'm an artist and Cape Cod is featured in my book and I made it by hand. And that was something that like when I was younger, I would have never done.
Mm-hmm.
That felt like such a big feeling in itself. It's scary when you're an artist to just go up to people and sort of network and promote yourself.
Totally. Yeah.
So yeah. I felt really proud of myself for doing that. And it just felt like, oh, this thing is really taking off. If the thing that I made by hand is taking off, then I should look into actually getting it published. And after a short while, I found an independent publisher who, reasonably so, in their first email was like, we were really concerned when you said you have a poetry book, but after reading this, because I get that, and that's why I don't think I showed people my poetry a lot. After showing it to them, they were like, no, we need to share this because this is really important. And I refinessed the illustrations, but they still have this sort of lino cut feel. They have like the white line and the negative positive space. And so yeah, now it's an actually published book, and it's just sort of an adventure that it took me on that I never thought it would take me on.
Yeah. Do you have a particular poem you might want to read? Just to give kind of people because we spend a lot of time talking about the print side of things and your print practice, but
yeah,
a poem that is just seems appropriate, I guess, if you were going to share one that you would share.
I think then I'm going to pick In Isolation We Stir, because I feel like that's very on par to what we're talking about. And it's also, it's one of the more introductory poems to what is happening in the overall story. So it kind of sets the tone for the rest of the book.
Sounds perfect.
Okay, cool. In isolation, we stir. A diner, a beach, a memory. I disperse pieces of my soul on the shores of Cape Cod. My life, now breadcrumbs. The seagulls cannot steal. The place where I grew up every summer became the place where I scattered my father's ashes, buried in the sand and the memories, merging with the seashells in childhood. I don't recognize these streets anymore. The doors close on Manhattan. Lights retire after 40 years of business. Broadway took a vow of silence. Restaurants starve on the sidewalk. The city that never sleeps lies awake at night, holding its breath, clutching restlessly, wreaking havoc on subway veins. New York City can't come to the phone right now. I need to be around other people to know people are still here. But home can be a haven when you are forced to leave it, a luxury to return. There are locked doors on the places of my memory, moments I shared, people I laughed with. If we cannot go back to the places where we left ourselves behind, what will become of our souls?
Wow, that's really interesting. I feel like I started to get even bigger feels when you were describing New York and just some of those details about like how home is a haven when you're only when you're forced to leave it. And how, you know, how everything really shifted during that time. And so, you know, your home where it's supposed to be that place that you come back to and you get that sense of relief and your animals are there and your family is sometimes there and just your things, and how it really just became these little boxes that were to be endured during that time. And and the empty cities. And this has been a really interesting conversation, because I've just through hearing you describe things in general, not just in the poem.
Yeah.
I've been feeling a lot of that anxiety's kind of return, out of that familiar anxiety.
So sorry.
No, it's okay. not like return to stay.
Yeah.
But like that my body remembering what it was like. And I think that feeling of not knowing when it was going to end and all of that kind of thing. So, and just really the really intense fear, like when you were talking about having to leave your partner and not knowing if he was going to be okay. And then that feeling of going to stay with your mother. And then of course, like having COVID as well. And then there's that, like, did you give it to her? Who, you'll never know. Right.
Exactly.
She was also working in a doctor's office, but just all of that. Yeah. That fear. So it reminds me of that classic phrase of like, the only way out is through, when it comes to, I think, processing and understanding the complexity of grief that's both on this global scale through something like the pandemic, but then also on the super individual scale of personal loss. And, you know, as we spoke to, like, you and I both have lost our fathers in recent years, neither from COVID directly, but so many people did lose people directly in that time period from the virus. And so it's just a really complex, heavy emotional soup that I think everyone maybe has an element of wanting to turn a blind eye to it.
Yeah.
But poets don't turn blind eyes. That's not what they do.
I remember when my husband read it, he was so upset afterwards and was like, I didn't know that you were feeling this deeply. Mm. And I was like, well, you know, writing. Like, he felt like he misunderstood or he missed something.
Oh,
After reading. And I was like, no, he was the most kind. And he also loved my dad. He was the most kind and supportive partner I could have had through that, all of that. But there's something about poets. We just, we got to make things sad. Not always, but it's a different way of channeling the experience. It doesn't mean that he didn't participate in the things that were happening when I was writing it. Mm-hmm. It's just, I think for him, and when you read poetry, it's like you're shifting the context of a situation a little bit. I had a really great therapist once who told me, and this is when I was helping my mom move out of her apartment, and that wasn't even a year into me grieving, and I had to throw away all of these childhood things that I wasn't necessarily sure if I was ready to get rid of, but at the time I was like, we just got to get mom out of here.
Yeah.
And I had a therapist who said, it's like a storm and you just have to wait it out. And I think about that in so many uncomfortable situations where it's sort of like our natural reaction to flee from something. But sometimes, just like a storm, you just have to keep moving.
Yeah, it's really interesting that you say that. I have a really similar mantra, if you want to call it that, which is, my favorite book is Lonesome Dove, which is a story of cowboys bringing a herd of cattle from basically Texas to Montana. And at one point they're out on the open plains and they realize that a swarm of grasshoppers is coming at them. Like, they think it's a storm cloud. But then as it gets closer, it's these massive storms of grasshoppers that can sometimes exist in open plains.
Really?
And it's coming at the herd of cattle, and it's they're eating the grass as they go, and one of the younger cowboys turns to the captain of the team and is like, it's bugs. Like, what are we going to do? And the captain just says, live through it.
Yeah, that's exactly it. And, you know, like I said, with the pandemic, with personal experiences, it's sort of in our natural response to panic and flee something that is scary. But sometimes you have to kind of hold on harder during those times.
Yeah.
And, you know, even when I realized that my body was reacting to something, maybe because COVID was scary or because I was grieving or experiencing a trigger of PTSD, instead of fearing that sensation, I wanted to love it, because that meant that my body was in some way trying to protect me.
Yeah.
Like, there were times, especially when you have PTSD in general and you don't have a pandemic. Before I was diagnosed, I was going to places, when I was finally meeting up with people again, I was going to places that I had no recollection of being to before. And that can be kind of scary, especially somebody who likes control and is like very neurotic. The idea of seeing a place and being like, oh my God, I've been here before, or like, I passed a bakery once and was like, oh, that sounds interesting. I think I want to check that place out, just to realize that I'd been to that bakery before multiple times. It was the place where I ordered my birthday cake the day my dad passed.
Right.
And that my brain had told itself, like, you don't know this place.
Yeah.
Instead of being like terrified that my body was like trying to lie to me in some way, I wanted to sort of honor what it was trying to do and just accept that, like, you did something to protect me. And now we're seeing it again, and we're going to accept that that's what this place is and try to work through those feelings.
Yeah.
Ooh, yeah.
I know. I feel like, you know, where do you go from here?
I know. I feel so bad when my poetry and my artwork are so sad, because I'm a very like chill, happy-go-lucky person. Like, when I talk to people about my artwork, they're like, especially people in my life who know me and know me as this like positive person, they're like, oh my God, what did she do? And I'm like, what? I just made something.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, and I think continuing to make and continuing to work is, I don't want to say like the obligation, because that sounds too, what I want to say. It's like more like keeping time and keeping the emotional history and the emotional record of times like this is what artists do. And it is, of course, through our individual lens, because that's how the world works. I walk around looking out of my own flesh suit. So that is the only way so far I've been ever able to perceive the world. But even in the specific, it becomes such an incredible record of a time and a place that people were going through. So your personal processing, even I think, as you said, when it is, is it sad, it is accurate, and it is a, it's a part of history now.
And it happened during this time. And I think that we look at other artwork and can acknowledge that it was a part of time. But it's hard for us to place that same sentiment on us while we're experiencing this thing.
Yeah.
I do feel like printmaking has such a rich history in protesting and going against something else. I think that was also part of my reason for printing my own book, because I was like, well, I don't know if anybody's going to like this or if anybody's going to publish it. So I'm going to do it myself, you know, but it feels like at the time, like nobody knew that we were in that little printmaking studio in New York City. And now that I have all of this work out of it, I do feel like it sort of like encapsulated this moment in time that now we are looking back on and thinking like, oh my gosh, like, yes, at the time we were so scared and feeling all of these feelings, but now we can sort of uncover all of these little things that were happening around us at that time too.
Yeah. Yeah. Courtney, where can people find your book? Where can people find you out there?
Yeah. So my book is called Lost Objects and Found Memories. And it's under an independent publisher who I'm really, just really excited about seeing what they do in 2024. They're like revving up to do a lot of bunch of cool new things. And I'm so excited for them. I'm so excited to be like on this journey with Wandering Minds. And so you can go there, you can go to their website and find my book there. You can also find me on Instagram. That's honestly my preferred form of social media. It's visual. It's easy. I go by at my Coco. It's three Co's. Coco was a family nickname, and Stella Star was a 2000s indie New York band, and they had a song called My Coco. And that's been my Instagram name ever since, and I've never changed it. So you can find me there. And my website, which you can also find on my Instagram as well. That's just Courtney Traley, Wixie site. That's it.
Beautiful. I'll put links to that in the show notes. And thank you for going on the journey and having the talks and marking time, marking experience. So, yeah.
Thank you so much for sharing this with me. I feel like this was such a fulfilling conversation, and we literally have just met, and it was just like so full of experience, and it was really wonderful.
Yeah, thank you.
Just a quick note, print friends. Since we recorded this episode, Courtney's publisher has rebranded to Bryson Publishing. They also reprinted her poetry book in better quality. And a percentage of those sales will go to Frontline Arts in New Jersey. So check out the link in the show notes for that one. If you like today's episode, we have a Patreon where you can help support our podcast and get bonus content, like Shop Talk Shorts with past guests. But the very, very best thing you can do to support this podcast is listen, rate, follow, and share with your fellow print friends around the world. And that's our show for this week. Join me again in 2 weeks' time when my guest will be Hannah O'Brien, who lives her life making prints with her cat while sailing up and down the East Coast of the United States. We talk about setting up a print studio in a space that's always moving, feline studio assistants, and online branding. You won't want to miss it. This episode, like all episodes, was written and produced by me, Miranda Metcalf, with editing from Timothy Pawshak and music by Joshua Weber. I'll see you in 2 weeks.